Our pets are really part of the family for most of us, and I think while the word pet mostly brings up a mental image of a dog or a cat, there are many other types of animals that are fascinating and fun to have around. And folks that have an exotic pet will tell you that they are just as attached to their pet as you might be to your dog or your cat. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Dr. Kurt Slatke, my guest today, is a clinical associate professor in zoological medicine and section head of the Special Species Health Service at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. He has an incredible range of experience and a depth of knowledge in the care of exotic pets. We're really happy to have him back today to answer your questions about exotic pet care. Looking forward to hearing from you. You may have a question or comment. Do you have an exotic pet? What kind? Would you like to have one or interested in it? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you've got a photo of your exotic pet, send that along as well. Dr. Slatke, welcome. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much, Larry. Happy New Year, and Happy New Year to all of your listeners.
To you as well. What are some of the most common exotic pets that you see at the vet school?
I'd say it's changed over the years. I'd say that 10 years ago we saw a lot more birds, and nowadays we're seeing a lot of small mammals, so rodents, rats and rabbits, chinchillas, guinea pigs. We tend to see quite a few. Right now, I'd say small mammals are the most popular pets.
Yeah, I see. We have a Facebook comment from Wilbur. Oh, no, it's not from Wilbur. Wilbur is listener Todd. He posted a photo on the Facebook page, and we'll get to that, of his hognose snake. And I'm going to see if we can get that up on my Facebook page here. But he says the snake, there he is, hates me but loves my wife, which only points to his good taste and judgment. And then someone asked Todd how you know if a snake likes you or not. And Todd says, well, he hisses, he throws his little hood and strikes at me. But when Heidi walks up, he calms down and looks at her with as much love as a serpent can master. If snakes had eyelids, he'd bat the matter.
when people say that they're attached to their dog or cat, or their cat or dog is attached to them, you can see that this is a great case for a reptile being attached to one individual in the family.
Yeah, it's great, and you can believe it, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's to me, because we deal with exotic pets all the time, it doesn't matter what species it is. People are attached to their pets, whether it's a tarantula, a rodent, a rabbit, a snake, or a bird.
Yeah. Carol sent us a photo as well. She said she has two painted turtles that she's raised from hatchlings. And you've got a picture of Gus living large in his summer pool, and Squirtle. They have to live in separate areas because of aggression issues. My turtle Squirtle often has a scum form on the water, while it never happens to Gus. Both are cared for the same way. They eat the same, and I clean their containers once a week. But for some reason, one turtle gets the scum on the water and the other one doesn't.
I wonder what the scum, what she means by scum, if it's just like a surface, like an oily surface. You know, each turtle is going to, they urinate and they defecate in their water in aquatic turtles. And so each turtle may have different bacteria in their gastrointestinal tract or urinary tract that they're kind of expressing in the water. And that may be a function of the scum. Alternatively, some turtles will occasionally regurgitate food material or mucus from their mouth, and maybe it's just an individual difference that one turtle and not the other is either passing different bacteria from the urinary or gastrointestinal tract, mm-hmm. or it's coming out of the mouth.
Very interesting. Well, a couple of photos there, and up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, so you might want to take a look at those and post one of your own while you're up there if you've got an exotic pet. Let's talk about some of the services that you offer exotic pets at the vet school. It's a pretty unique services, I think.
Right. I think people don't think of the vet school all the time as a teaching hospital, and so we function very much like University of Wisconsin Human Hospital in that we have multiple disciplines, multiple experts across multiple areas of medicine, from oncology to dermatology to anesthesiology, and us, we're in zoological medicine. And we, my students and my residents are trained not only in exotic pet medicine, but also zoo animal medicine, aquatic or aquarium animal medicine, and wildlife, free-ranging wildlife medicine as well. And within our service, when we're in our clinical service, the Special Species Health Service, we have a lot of different diagnostic modalities that most other veterinary clinics that see exotic pets do not have. And that would include things like CT scans and MRIs and other imaging, other diagnostic imaging techniques. So, plus if your animal has cancer, some sort of tumor, we can consult with the oncology service about best practice, best ways to treat that patient. Same with ophthalmology. Our ophthalmologists are right there to help us evaluate eye disease. So we're prepared not only from our own service, but we have access to all of the other services in the vet school to do the best possible medicine and surgery that we can do on our patients.
You know, we've covered this before, but I think it really deserves repeating. You are board certified in zoological medicine, and only about 130 people in the world have that similar training.
Right. So my training, and I actually have residents that I train in zoological medicine as well now, but my training was doing a residency and taking a board exam that isn't very fun. That board exam, the reason why so few people are boarded in zoo medicine is they haven't been trained properly and the range of species that you need to know for passing the exam, from whales to spiders to sea anemones, it can be quite intense. The training can be quite intense and take a while to get through it all.
And a Facebook question from Sally, who says we've been tempted to buy the young bearded dragons we've seen at the area pet store chain. How difficult are these to keep healthy for the optimal lifespan of, I believe, 10 years?
Yeah, bearded dragons, of all the reptiles, I'd say bearded dragons are the most popular reptile pets we see. They're they're generally very good first reptile pets. They typically are easygoing. They eat, they're known to be insectivores in the wild, but they in captivity we try to feed them a variety of green salads, salad, a little bit of fruit, and some insects as well. The health problems that we see in most reptiles have to do with husbandry, and that would be are you keeping the animal at the appropriate temperature, humidity? Are you feeding it appropriately? So you'll want to do a little bit of research about appropriate diet, and if you end up getting a bearded dragon and you want advice about what aquarium to put it in, what substrate to keep it on, what food to feed it, please come and see us or please call us.
Yeah. The education, I think, is an important part of owning an exotic pet.
I think,
like any pet, frankly.
I think it's a big chunk of our daily visit with most of our clients is discussing appropriate husbandry, feeding, because it's so difficult and there are so many people giving the wrong advice. Oftentimes people will get some advice from the pet store, the internet, and oftentimes it's not the advice that's most appropriate.
Yeah, we had a Facebook comment, or maybe it was an email, Facebook comment from Becca wondering about some animals. The sugar gliders has come up recently as an example of a pet. Chinchilla is another one. She notes that they often live short, poor lives due to the care, improper care, which was what we were just talking about. And they're also surrendered to shelters, given away, and so forth. And the same goes for, should they be kept in a home or not? And the same goes for large snakes, for example. Certainly wouldn't be happy living in a bathtub.
Right. I think, I think small mammals and reptiles, you see a lot of people giving up dogs and cats on Craigslist. Certainly people, unfortunately, people give some small rodents and rabbits as pets. Easter time is a very popular time to give rabbits as pets and ducklings. And you should never do that. That's not a good idea, to just surprise somebody with a rabbit or a duck. And I would say that the whole sugar glider issue, really, in City of Madison, we see a lot of sugar gliders as pets that come to the vet school. And they're not the easiest pet to take care of. They have very specific dietary needs, but they tend to be our clients who are sugar glider owners are absolutely dedicated, and most of them have multiple sugar gliders. Some of the laws, the Madison law that was set up, that's being described now for perhaps introducing sugar gliders to be maintained legally, that law was originally set up for lions and bears and large primates and venomous snakes. And so I think, practically speaking, there are a lot of sugar glider pets out there, and I think it's probably reasonable for the city of Madison to go ahead and accept sugar gliders as pets.
They're like a small, large-eyed squirrel.
Yeah, so it's a marsupial, and it is in the wild. It is a sort of nectivorous, so it's a nectar eater and a gum eater, gum from trees. So therefore, their diet is very specific, and it's somewhat difficult to actually mimic that diet in captivity. So they have big eyes. They have sort of that cute baby-like face, big eyes, a big fleshy nose, and they have extra skin on their limbs, so that they're kind of like a flying squirrel in that sense, in that they can jump through the trees in the wild. So they're tree living species.
Hmm. It's interesting to me that because of what you have, because of your techniques, because of your training and so forth, for students who want to be veterinarians, this has got to be just an unbelievable place to come to study, because they have some incredible opportunities to work with zoo animals.
Right. In fact, the university on the website now, there's a really nice story about our teaching our students and our resident, Sarah Churgin, in zoo medicine. And I think a lot of we're finding more and more each year students choosing to come to Wisconsin because of access to what we would call, again, zoological medicine, which would include the exotic pet service, the access to zoo animals at the Milwaukee Zoo and the Byles Zoo, and free-ranging wildlife. I have a current student who spent a chunk of August in Costa Rica doing a sloth study. So my students get exposed not only to exotic pets regularly, my fourth-year students, but my fourth-year students will sometimes make a trip to the Milwaukee Zoo. and even do wildlife, free-ranging wildlife, anywhere in the world. So I've had students in Costa Rica. I've had students in African countries. I've had students do free-ranging wildlife work here as well in the States.
Dr. Kurt Sladke, Clinical Associate Professor in Zoological Medicine and Section Head of the Special Species Health Service at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest as we talk with him about exotic pet care. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about exotic pet care today with Dr. Kurt Sladke of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to him for coming by. Thank you for listening in. Questions? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question, a comment, or a photo right there. We'd love to hear from you. And we're talking about zoo animals. And I know tomorrow, Renee and Emily and I will be in Orlando for a few days at Disney. And the program they have there for their animals, you might call them zoo animals in a way, although they get a pretty free range.
Right.
There is a fantastic, and I've really enjoyed. My daughter will sit for an hour and watch the veterinarians because there's an observation area. You can watch them do surgery. We watched them operate on a zebra and on some birds, and it's quite interesting.
Yeah, that's the group down there. I know several of them, and several of them are actually board certified in zoological medicine. So they are part of the University of Florida training program for training residents in zoological medicine. And Disney's Animal Kingdom is a lot of fun. And the colleagues of mine that are down there, I see them certainly at an annual meeting once a year. But there are several good friends who are vets down there. Really, really good staff.
Yeah, good people. Victor in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello, good morning, and good morning to your guests. My big interest are toucans. I've liked them ever since childhood, but my concern is the environment, especially being up here in Wisconsin. Are they adaptable to, like, temperature, or are they sensitive to temperature and humidity? And my other concern is, where can I get one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hi, Victor. Toucans are one of the toughest bird species to maintain as a pet. Their diet is difficult to mimic. Some of the commercial diets that are offered are too high in iron and destroy their liver. They require, obviously, they're tropical birds, and they just don't adapt as well as some of the other tropical species. Like macaws are tropical species, and many are maintained as pets, but they seem to do okay in Wisconsin. Toucans are just extremely difficult. They're absolutely beautiful birds. Even in the zoo world, I've dealt with toucans, and even really experienced bird keepers have a hard time keeping toucans, maintaining them for a long life. And also, you have mentioned, where do you get them? I'm not familiar with any pet stores around here that sell toucans. I don't have an answer for you about that.
Mm. There you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call, Victor. Leslie in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, I was calling because I have raised a raccoon from a little teeny infant I had because he was abandoned, very well trained and everything else, but I was always afraid of where do I go to get him a rabies shot to keep him from being bitten from anything, and also how do I get rid of that so-called disease they keep in their intestines as opposed to infect people. He's perfectly healthy, but I heard about those two things, and those are my questions.
Hi, Leslie. Raccoons carry a number of diseases that are a couple of which are called zoonotic diseases, meaning that they can be transmissible from the raccoon to people. So keeping raccoons as pets, usually it's first of all, it's illegal in the state of Wisconsin because they're native wildlife, and they require a DNR permit to maintain them. Secondly, they carry a disease, a nematode called Balanus ascaris, and most raccoons have this nematode in their feces, and they pass it in their feces, and they... it is a nematode that, if ingested by people, and it can migrate into the brain, and the larva can kind of migrate through the brain, causing severe neurologic damage and death. And so keeping raccoons as pets, we discourage it. We strongly discourage it because of that particular disease. But they also carry rabies and distemper, and so it's not actually... legal for us as vets to vaccinate raccoons that are maintained as pets against rabies.
Mm.
However, things are possible to do that. Now, this nematode, is it some sort of bacteria that is necessary for their digestion, like ours has E. coli? Otherwise, we don't digest.
No, it's a parasite. So it's not part of their bacterial flora. It's actually a parasite that most raccoons carry, and it does nothing really, unless there's a massive number, it really does little to no damage to raccoons. But any other species, including humans, that ingest, ingest that parasite egg that lives, that sits in their feces, will potentially have this the larva. They ingest the egg, the larva grow up and migrate into your central nervous system. So I've seen, in the zoo world, I've seen orangutans, I've seen birds, I've seen hoofstock, many species affected by this particular nematode. So it's really I would call it a highly dangerous nematode for people. And raccoons defecate in latrines, so you'll find that raccoons will defecate in sandboxes, kids' sandboxes, because they like sand. Mm. It's just like a cat. And children will eat raccoon feces and get this nematode, swallow this nematode egg, and it can have devastating effects.
So that's it, Leslie. I hope you pay attention to what Dr. Sladke has said here. Appreciate your call.
Sorry to scare you.
Yeah. Thanks again for calling. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And I want to go back to the story. You mentioned that there was a nice story written about the vet school and your work with zoo animals, and we have that posted. And we also, there was a video along with it, and we have that video posted on my Facebook page as a comment on our segment status. So if you're interested in learning about what goes on with zoo animals at the UW Vet School, in addition to asking questions here of Dr. Sladke, you can sort of see it in action.
Yeah, it's a video. They focused mostly on my current resident, Sarah Churgin, and she was working on a hyena at the Milwaukee Zoo. Milwaukee Zoo is part of our resident program. So they train, my residents train here, train at the Crane Foundation in Baraboo, and train at the Milwaukee Zoo. And we're hoping in the next couple of years with the new Animal Health Center at the Vila Zoo that we'll be more directly involved there as well. So that's a neat story. The video, you'll get to see a hyena immobilized for a quarantine exam. And then Terry Devitt did a nice written piece about our students, interviewing some of our fourth-year students who come through our service.
What are the pleasures in your mind of having an unusual or an exotic pet?
The pleasures?
Yeah.
I would say that, people always try to distinguish between dogs and cats and exotic pets as pets. Mm-hmm. And I would say that, of course, I'm biased, and I see a lot of people who own exotic pets. I would say that people become so attached to their exotic pets. Again, whether it's a rat or a rabbit or a bird. And in many cases, to be honest, I think, you know, much like dogs and cats, I think people sometimes prefer their pet over their spouse in many instances. I think when you own an exotic pet, there's a lot that you need to read up about, and I think it engages people more maybe than a dog and cat, feeding your dog and cat. You have to learn a lot, and there are little changes that you always need to make with the environment and with feeding. So I think people who own exotic pets really tend to be thoughtful and read up a lot about it. And if they don't, we try to help them read up about it.
I was trying to think back in my own life as a young, probably 10 years old, I had rabbits, which I really enjoyed. And over the years, I've had birds, several parakeets typically, and a lot of fish. And I've enjoyed all of them.
So you're an exotic pet owner.
Well,
going way back.
Way back, yeah. Facebook question from Kat. We have two new lovely Java finches. Can we supplement their seed diet with any greens or freeze-dried mealworms or other items? Any advice on how to determine gender when they are mature? And what about recommending an internet resource for reliable pet bird advice?
Yeah, boy, internet. I tend to try to steer people clear of internet advice because there's so much. There's some good stuff out there, but there's an awful lot of really awful advice. Java finches, in terms of determining gender, you probably won't be able to. In terms of feeding, I would recommend that you look into all seed diets for any bird is usually just a high fat diet with very, very little to no vitamin supplementation. I might encourage you to look at some of the pelleted diets out there that finches can eat. One might be Harrison's diet, and you can Google Harrison's bird food. And I have no attachment to Harrison's. It's just, I think, a good quality diet. And look at Zupreme as well as a pelleted diet. That's another, well-recognized diet that's been in the zoo world for many years. So if you want to improve their nutrition, I would try, and this is easier said than done, try to convert them off a seed diet to an actual pelleted diet, which is just a better nutritional package.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me, Dr. Kerry Donahue will be with us in 10 minutes or so to talk about choosing the right diet for your pet. So we're going to continue on that diet route. Mary Ann in Antioch, Illinois, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello.
And what's up?
Yes, I was calling. My husband and I have started a family project as of 3 months ago. We actually have three chickens and two roosters, we just found out.
Ooh.
Yes, we've got the Japanese bantam, two of those, a silky, and then an Easter egger, the Americana. Yeah. And my question to you was, you were talking about the raccoons and how it's not good to, you know, have them as a pet, per se. It's illegal in Wisconsin. Now, with chickens, my children are under the age of 15, and they handle them daily. They're not in the house. They have their own coop, but the children are literally handling them daily.
So you're worried about health risks to your kids?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure there wasn't anything I missed.
Yeah, so in general, there aren't, there are bacteria in their feces, and chickens, I think the biggest worry in chickens is salmonella, much like reptiles. So
right.
Salmonella, if you're an owner of a chicken or you're an owner of a reptile, we always encourage you to certainly wash your hands well after handling, and don't go eat your peanut butter sandwich after you've handled the chicken. And so just good hygiene practices. In terms of diseases that might jump, other diseases that might jump from chicken to people, there really aren't a lot of major concerns there. And chickens make great pets. They can be very friendly. Now, roosters maybe not. Roosters, when they become adults, can be extremely aggressive and uncontrollably aggressive.
And noisy.
But so the behavioral issues, once they become adults, may be a limiting factor. But in terms of disease, just good, proper hygiene after handling chickens, because their feathers are covered with feces. I mean, or can be, and if several of them are together. So tell your kids to wash their hands, or just buy them some gloves when they handle the chickens.
Yeah.
Some latex gloves or nitrile gloves or any gloves. I mean, that's what we tend to get our students to do when a pet chicken comes in, if they have to do a lot of handling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since we got them as itty bitties, we have been practicing good hygiene. Very good hygiene.
Yeah.
And that's gotten to be a popular kind of pet, in a way, and also a provider of eggs here in Madison and elsewhere in Wisconsin.
We see them fairly frequently at the vet school, and people are keeping, even in the city of Madison, where you can keep a few in your backyard, pet chickens are very popular.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And, I mean, you would not believe how social these birds are. I mean, you know, the kids will wrap the chicken up in a special towel, disposable towels, and they just carry them around like they're little babies, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah, and that speaks to the idea with a lot of exotic pets, is the more you spend time with them and the more you handle them, the better off the animal will be toward a variety of different people. That's not always true with all exotic pets, but oftentimes the more you handle them, the more easygoing they will be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I definitely have to say that the silky chicken is the most docile chicken of them all.
Okay, there you go. Marianne.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Marianne. Appreciate your call. A couple of caller Ruth suggested that for telling the gender of a Java finch, she says there are subtle differences in their beaks. Is that true?
Yeah, there can be subtle color differences, slightly different colors. But practically speaking, it's pretty hard to determine.
Matthew emailed us from Madison. We're keeping a jumping spider we found in our house as a pet until spring. So they found a spider. We're keeping it as a pet. We bought some crickets at a pet store, and he's eaten them. Is there anything else we should be feeding him?
You know, if you're feeding, most spiders are obviously going to eat things like crickets, and you have to buy the appropriate size cricket for the spider. But it's really important to feed the crickets an appropriate diet. So it's what we call gut loading your crickets. So your crickets need to be fed an appropriate diet so that they become a good nutritional package for the spider.
Oh.
So put your crickets on something like Flukers makes a cricket diet. They make a gel, sort of a gel diet. I usually feed my crickets not only the gel diet, so they have water in the gel, but also the pelleted Flukers diet, or you can buy a chick starter feed, just chicken starter feed and some water or some vegetable matter like cucumbers to provide the crickets water. And that's another way of gut loading the cricket to make them so your crickets are good, a good nutritional package for your spider.
Ah, excellent. David in Triple I, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, I have a question regarding, I'd like to know what your guest, any information he has on Patagonian tabbies as pets indoor.
Yeah, so we don't see Patagonian cavies as pets very much, but it's you know, I've read about it, and it's, you know, it's, I think it's a pet that is going to be higher maintenance. Most people view them as a you know, another version of a chinchilla or guinea pig, and I think again, what do we feed them most appropriately in captivity? We don't really have a good answer for that. So it's a species that may become really popular in the near future, much like some of the other exotic pets. But for now, I would say that it's a species that is a little more high maintenance. You might be better off having a chinchilla or guinea pig.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you, David, so much. Appreciate your call and your question and concerns. And Dr. Slabke, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew.
Yeah, it did fly. Thanks, Larry. It was fun being here again. I really appreciate it. And I always get great questions.
So. Yeah, I hope you'll come back and do it again.
Absolutely.
Oh,
thanks again.
Thank you. Dr. Kurt Slabke, Clinical Associate Professor in Zoological Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And once again, I hope you'll go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's we have the article that was written about his work with zoo animals, and also a really nice video that talks about, zeroes in on one of his, kind of one of his students, but her work over at the Milwaukee Zoo with some animals, and really pretty cool photos. Some of the questions that came up actually had to do with diets. It's interesting to find out the range of exotic pets we have, but coming up next, we're going to continue talking about pets and zero in on diets, probably for dogs and cats, though, this time around. Our guest coming up, Dr. Carrie Donahue from Full Circle Veterinary Clinic, she works mostly with dogs and cats. So we'll talk about choosing the right diet for your dog and or cat. Larry Mueller here. Stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.